Welcome to the Gathering Resources. The following audio is from our breakout session entitled Unaccompanied Migrant Children, Addressing the Crisis Through Philanthropy. This session is moderated by Salime Weatherford and features Victor Hinojosa and Lisa Trevino Cummins.
Hola, friends.
There you go.
Thank you so much for being here. We're about to start, so go find your seats, please. And so, unaccompanied minors, that's what we're going to talk about in this breakout session. We know that it is a highly politicized subject. I know that you probably come with opinions and thoughts about all of what's happening. You've seen those images of minors and children crossing the borders from Central America. And again, this is a highly politicized subject. However, this is also something that allows us as Christians to come into and learn and prayerfully think about what we are called to do within this messy, hard, complicated reality that we are facing nowadays. So let's be prayerful, let's be humble, let's try to learn. You're not going to get all the answers for all your questions. Again, this is a very complex situation, but by God's grace, we have two amazing people that are studying, and will give us some information that will hopefully spur us into pressing onto God and seeing where we're called to do or how we're called to get involved through this. So I want to introduce Victor Hinojosa. He is in Baylor. He is a professor at Baylor, and he is not only studying in academia about the root issue, why are people from Latin America coming here, but also innovative ways to help in this situation. So, Victor, why don't you start us off?
Well, thank you. Thanks for that, and thanks for having me here. This is just an amazing group of people. It's just been an honor to be around you and soaking up all of this from all of you. So, as Salima said, we want to talk about the unaccompanied minors. I'm sure you've seen snippets of this. Since about 2014, more than 1 million children and families have fled three countries, Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras. We call those the Northern Triangle countries in Central America. And these children and families have fled their homes, come to the United States to request asylum. About half of those are what we call the unaccompanied minors, children who make this journey alone without one of their parents. And as Salima says, I teach at Baylor and am a researcher at the Baylor Collaborative on Hunger and Poverty, and for the last few years have been heading up a team of students and staff and faculty who we've been trying to understand who are these children and families, why are they fleeing, and how can we develop innovative solutions to keep them from having to make the journey to flee. And what we find is that these children and families are fleeing two primary things. They're fleeing violence, and they're fleeing hunger. Now, those two are complicated and they're interconnected, but violence, for a time in the mid-2010s, these three countries had three of the five highest homicide rates in the world. San Pedro Sula in Honduras, for a while, had the distinction of being the most violent city in the world, not in a war zone, a distinction it has lost recently to Caracas, Venezuela, and that's a whole other story that we could talk about the Venezuelan refugees
as well. What city did you
say? San Pedro Sula in Honduras. The violence in these three countries is complicated. Some of it is tied to transnational organized crime, mostly the international drug trade. Most of it is actually tied to local crime networks and local extortion networks. You've probably heard about the MS-13 and the Barrio 18 street gangs, which control local crime. And then a lot of the violence is family violence. It's domestic violence, abuse in the home. In all three cases, the government is unable to keep you safe. So if you're a Mayan farmer and the drug traffickers force you off your land because it's on a smuggling route or because they need that land to build a clandestine airstrip, if you're a successful small business owner and the gangs start to extort your small business, or if you're just a parent and you have teenagers and the gangs start to forcibly recruit your teenage son or your teenage daughter for the gangs, or if you're being abused by a family member, tell the authorities, by all means tell the authorities, but they're not going to be able to keep you safe. Either in some cases because of corruption, but in most cases it's simply a lack of institutional capacity. They just can't keep you safe. And of course, the gangs and the transnational criminal groups have broad reach. They can find you if you flee your home. And at the beginning of the crisis, violence really was the primary driver. But what we've seen in the last couple of years is that the primary driver of child and family migration is actually now food insecurity. It's hunger. And this is similarly complicated, but Guatemala has one of the highest rates of child malnutrition anywhere in the world, and severe acute cases of child malnutrition doubled just from 2019 to 2020. And similarly, food insecurity and hunger are complicated. Part of this relates to long-standing structural inequality, poverty, lack of job opportunities in these countries. Part of it is changes in food production, which has been driven by drought and global climate change. So much of Central America now is in what we call the drought corridor, which in the last 5 years has seen severe drought. And the changing global climate means that traditional crops and traditional farming techniques no longer work. So there's a Central America is now warmer than it used to be, so it's more humid than it used to be, and a rust, a fungus that destroys coffee crops didn't used to ever be prevalent in Central America, now is, and it's wiping out coffee production. What American audiences often don't realize is that not only does this affect farmers and subsistence farmers, but a third of all employment in Central America is in the ag sector. So when crops fail, people lose their jobs, and that just further fuels this cycle of unemployment, poverty, food insecurity. The UN World Food Program tells us that over 1 million people in these three countries are in emergency food insecurity right now, and that most of these families have done the kinds of emergency things you do when you're struggling to put food on the table. They've borrowed money from friends and family. They've taken out loans if they have access to credit markets. Many of them have already sold their land to buy food. There's nothing more these families can do except to migrate, right? On top of all that, as if it couldn't be any worse, on top of all that, of course, the pandemic has just exacerbated the economic crisis in the region. And Honduras was hit with two Category 5 hurricanes in the same month in November of 2020. So now it's time for an awkward transition, right? I've just hit you with a whole lot of really discouraging information. I'm a hit at parties, right? I don't get invited to parties very often. If we had more time, I'd ask you to sit with that, but we don't have more time, so I'm gonna make an awkward joke and move to what I think we can do about it. Because the good news is I think we can do some things about it, right? Look, the image I like to use is an image of a knotted up ball of twine. Can you picture a knotted up ball of twine in your head? Or if you ever go fishing and you're a better fisherman than I am, you know, your reel just explodes, right? And you've got fishing line going everywhere, right? So think about that for a second. You know that the worst thing you can possibly do when you've got this knotted up ball of twine is just grab on one end of the string and start pulling, right? That's just gonna make it worse. Unfortunately, that's what we're tempted to do, right? Hey, here's this huge problem. I've got a solution. Let's start tugging. The problem with intractable crises like this is that what you actually have to do is you have to attack this kind of problem from multiple ends simultaneously. You've got to start poking at that ball of twine from all sorts of places all at once. I actually think that's good news, right? I think that's good news. The people I work with, we firmly believe that when we each bring who we are to the table, when the job creators, the researchers, the policymakers, the trauma healers, the educators, the ag scientists, when we all come together and start working on this problem, we can make real progress. We have to do it together, however. Now, but I think that's when the magic happens, is when we start innovating and when we start not only doing this work together, but when we start learning from each other. When the academics learn from the practitioners, goodness knows, the academics need to learn from the practitioners, right? And the practitioners learn from the policymakers who learn from the scientists, and so on. In your app, I've given you just a one-page document. Believe me, that was the hardest part of preparing this talk, was to prepare something in one page, right? I mean, I can't clear my throat in one page. Thanks, I tried. But in that one-page document that's in your app, I tried to just spark your imagination. And I tried to give you ideas about how you might get involved and how you might come alongside this vulnerable population. I tried to give you interventions in Central America, interventions in the United States, 30,000 feet kind of stuff, like the stuff we're doing at Baylor that revolves around collective impact, things like job training and gang assistance programs, or the stuff we're doing at my church. My church is starting a hospitality house that I think is going to have a tremendous impact on, you know, three or four families, right? So wherever you feel led, called, if you're interested in trauma or legal work or the like, I tried to at least spark your imagination, and I'm happy to continue these conversations later. Hope this is just the start of that. I know Lisa's got a lot of good stuff to say, so let me just wrap up really quickly and say really one more big thing. And this is because it's fresh in my mind. Last week, I was on an expert panel at an event with the head of the United Nations World Food Program. And we were talking about the connection between hunger and migration. And one of the things that came out of this event was the need to expand our time horizons, right? So this head of the World Food Program keeps saying, look, I work with policymakers, and the problem is policymakers have really short time horizons. They're only thinking to the next election. And my hope is, being here with this community of philanthropists, you can help expand our time horizons. You can be willing to make a long-term investment in these kinds of crises and be willing to wait a while before you see the return on your investment. Because the kinds of problems I'm talking about, right? Intractable violence, food insecurity, and the like, those problems didn't come up overnight, right? And it's going to take us longer than one election cycle to overcome them, but I think we can. Look, nobody wants to make this journey. The kids that make this journey, we've written a children's book to sort of tell you about these kids. We have a few copies here. The kids that make this journey, they know what they're getting into, right? Their families know what they're getting into. They call the train that these kids ride, they call it the train of death. 80% of young women who make this journey are going to be sexually assaulted, right? People know this, and they do it anyway. Why? You heard me use the language of push factors, right? I talk about the things that push people to migrate. I have a pastor friend who works with this population in San Antonio, and he always gets mad at me when I talk about push factors. He says, Victor, the families I work with weren't pushed, they were thrown. They had to leave or their families would die. Nobody would make this journey otherwise. So the question, I think the challenge for us, is how do we create conditions in home countries where people don't have to make this journey? The Catholic social tradition calls this the right not to migrate. And what the encyclical tradition means here is that you have the right to live in safety and dignity where you are. And I think it's incumbent on us to help that make that right a reality. That makes sense, right? They have this right. Now let's help them actualize that so that people don't have to make that horrible journey. And thanks. I'll stop there.
Thank you, Victor. I think it is.
Thanks.
No, go for it. Please do. I think it is sobering to understand that this is not something that people are looking for. I mean, which mom in their five senses would put a little girl in a train where she's probably going to be sexually assaulted. She's going to have to travel through different countries where there are drug lords and there is violence, and still think that this is a better option for the girl. I mean, I cannot imagine doing that to my daughter, my sons. It is a harsh, harsh reality. And as Victor says, there are things that we can pray about doing. If you are called to do something in these countries, do it. If you're called to work with your church and welcome these kids, do it. If you're called to bring trauma care to these children, do it. But don't make it politicized, because what's at stake here is the lives of kids who do not want to make this trip and do not arrive to the best situation once they're here, and who are doing this legally. I think that that's important to say. I think that many, there's a misunderstanding that this is all illegal. And what we don't understand is that in order for these kids to have a legal claim for asylum, for refugee status, they have to be in the States. So that's a risk that they are in, they need to take. They need to be here in order to do that. So Lisa, I want to introduce Lisa. Lisa has a lot of experience with government and policy making and in government, but she also is helping kids that are coming to the U.S. in very tangible ways. And Lisa, why don't you tell us a little bit about what happens when they come here and how that plays out?
Yeah. It was good to hear you, Victor. Victor and I met on this topic at Baylor and have been friends, and he actually was a professor for my daughter, and so we have continued areas that we've worked on and want to continue working on. But thank you for this invitation to the gathering. It allows me to be here. I was here last year, but it was virtual, so it's way different being in person, so I'm glad for that. So I lead an organization called Urban Strategies, started it 18 years ago with the idea of engaging with the church, partnering with the church to engage in activities that are transformative in the lives of Latino communities. And so we've done that for the last 18 years. We do that in the United States, Puerto Rico, and then in the last years in Central America. And so our work is transformational, as I said, which implies long-term. And so we hesitate to get involved in event, episodic type things, because we want to go deeper. But in 2014, when we saw the videos that went out, that went viral, we saw the shape, that the condition that these children were in, we just thought, we can't just sit aside and set that aside and do nothing. And so we embarked on this journey to launch a program that we called Refugio. And we thought, you know, while we can't have these work with these children long term, let's, for the short term that we have, let's make the biggest impact that we can. And so we partner with the government, federal government, to provide a respite, a place of respite, if you will, for the children who are under 17 years old, under 18 years old, who are coming across the border and are determined unaccompanied minors. So unlike the Afghanistan refugees, and Miles done a great job in helping us learn about that, these children come without any benefits of status, and so, but they're here. And so the United States, I think it was in the 1980s with the Trafficking Act, we said if any child comes unaccompanied by an adult, without an adult, that we will provide care for them sufficient so that they can get on their way and not be trafficked. And so, and that's the law, it still happens a lot, but that prevented a lot of things. It prevents what trafficking could be, and it also set us up to say, we need to provide some care. So the government has contracted organizations like Urban Strategies. We're probably the smallest of all of that they contract with, and we provide a place of respite. So we have, we do that in two models. One is in a foster care model, where for tender age children under 12 years old, We've had a four-month-old, by the way. I don't know how that happened, but we've had very tiny ones. They come through, and then we have centers, and a couple in Florida, and then one in Waco, and then one here in California, in Pasadena, where we have recruited families from the church to get licensed as foster families. And then they take these children in. We have a day program for these children from 8 to 5, and then they go back with the families that they're with. And then we have another model for the 12 to 17-year-olds, who, which is residential care. And so that's 24/7. We have three locations, that one in the Rio Grande Valley, and then two in Florida. And I will tell you that, you know, everything that Victor has said, it should resonate with what I'm saying, because I think everything he said, we see that daily. We have kids coming, and I will tell you, the hardest thing for us to do is to help them settle down and laugh, because they want to get out and work, particularly the teens. They want to get out and work because, one, they want to support their family, or two, their family might owe somebody money for their trip to get here, and so they need to pay off whoever that person is. But they want to work, and so what we've discovered is we help them connect with connecting with those things that identifies activities for children. And so we have about 200 children in our care. They stay with us. Right now, the average day is about 20 days. It used to be about 45, but there's been some changes, and there's a lot of kids that are coming through. Again, it's kind of their family's last try at hope. And so they're coming through. We've had amazing, if only our American youth would be like those Latin American youth, we'd be a better country. And so they're amazing kids. What we have found that we struggle with is they leave our facility and then they go across the country. And this aftercare service, there are no aftercare services for them. And so they leave our facilities. They go to Los Angeles, Houston, New York, Chicago, Arkansas, and they go into families that are that most often are in poverty, who are struggling themselves. And there's a book, in addition to Victor's book, there's another that's called Enrique's Journey. Mm-hmm. And that it was written like 12 years ago. Unfortunately, the stories are still true today, still happening today. And it talks about the journey that that these young people go through. But they go into homes where they realize that they're reminded that they have siblings that they've never met. They go into homes where there's a language spoken, the English, that they don't know. They go into schools where that are overwhelmed with them, don't know what to do with them. And you know, imagine being a 15-year-old boy going into whatever grade they're gonna put him in, and he has no idea what's going on. And for me, and I think you might have said this yesterday about opportunity. Those are all challenges. Challenges for the community, it's challenges for the schools, it's challenges for all, but it's an opportunity for the church. Because they're coming to us, and we have an opportunity to open our hearts, open our arms, and you know what? You can develop programs. Really, they just need friendship. They need friendship to be on the journey with them. And so, to your question earlier about the technicalities, I also included a video on the app that is it's a animation of the process that children go through, the legal processes that they go through, and there's also a video that is interviewing the foster care families, and they talk about the children. They talk about how wonderful the children are, but you know what? They talk about how their own lives have been changed. And isn't that the way God works? He uses He uses those that are marginalized, that are put aside, that are thought of in a low way, and uses those to teach us. And so I think it's an opportunity for the church to live out its faith. It's an opportunity for us as individuals to be fulfilled. And I know that all of you are already you're all very, very charitable, very generous, and that you're at this meeting is heartwarming for us because this topic is not one that many in the church want to talk about. And quite frankly, the topic of refugees is more popular than the topic of these children who don't have refugee status, but they're in the same boat, if not worse. So I'm going to pause there and see where we go from there.
Thank you so much, Lisa. I think it is food for thought, right? We believe that only Christ gives hope. These kids are going from trauma into more trauma. Because they are, I mean, if you understand the legalities, many of these kids are representing themselves in legal court. And I mean, I would not, if my kid was ever in need of representation, I would probably hire the best. I would not let any of my kids represent themselves in court, in a different language, in a different place. And then they go to families or next of kin, where there's also a lot of problems, a lot of trauma. So I love what you said, Lisa, that what they need is touch, right? Like, Jesus touched the leper. Jesus saw the unseen. And it's not like a program. It is just like praying and saying like, hey, I know this Latino boy who is going through, you know, like a lot of hardship, and I can help sit down and mentor him. Or hey, I can help with job, or I can help with bringing him to my house and playing football, soccer, because we don't know football. It would be kind of hard. So soccer with them. But those are like universal ways of human contact and being the hands and feet of Jesus. So as Christ followers, we have an opportunity to help. As churches, we have an opportunity to help. And as believers, as donors, we have an opportunity to help. So I pray that as we serve and as we pray for the least of these, we could shine the hope of Christ in lives that are so traumatized and so broken and so hopeless, so that they might see that even though in this world we will have trouble and they've had trouble, Christ has overcome. So why don't we open this for question and answers, and let's see where that leads us.
While we're finding the first question, I was going to mention our friend John Garland's probably the point you're talking about, San Antonio.
Sure.
He's a Mennonite pastor in San Antonio, and he just like opens the door. They took out the pews of their in their church sanctuary and put cots for people passing through. And he says, Lisa, at least 50% of the folks that are coming through are evangelical Christians. They're evangelical Christians. And so in some ways, our work is affirming their faith when we step up, but really is proving our own faith. go ahead.
Sure. Thank you guys so much. Pastor Tim Keller says, you know, as a Christian, don't put me in a political box. Would love to know a little bit about, just so I can be more informed personally, but maybe it'll bless other people as well, just sort of what is being said right now politically as it relates to, those are immigrants, or, you know, there's been so much discussion about putting a wall up around Texas, you know, just the things that are happening that sometimes can be like, oh, you must be politically right if you want this, or you must be politically left if you're willing to love the kids at the border. How can we as Christians, from a like a theological standpoint, and obviously we think about loving our neighbor, but how do we think about the refugee, how do we think about the immigrant in a way that cuts through the noise of what politicians are trying to corner us into as perhaps people in America, but as Christians, how do we look at that from a unique lens?
I don't know if I'll give you much of a theological perspective, but I will say that when we first started this work, so we saw the videos, and then one of my closest friends who I work with, she was on a plane and headed to Houston. And next to her was one of these children who had come across the border and was being transported to Houston. And the story that she told him was incredible. And his name was Angel. And you know, and it took me to the scriptures that, and I can't quote where the scripture is, but where you don't know where there's angels some of them may come to you as angels, right, angels unaware. And it just turned my my perspective on these children. Who knows, but they may be angels. And certainly we know they're children of God. But anyway, that was the non-theological response, but I'll let these guys respond to that.
Yeah, so one of the things that gives me hope is I feel like the conversation is changing. And the reason I say that is I think we're finally starting to ask, why are these people migrating, right? Instead of demonizing the migrant or telling them not to migrate. Look, when this crisis started, the Obama administration said, don't come, and the whole first effort was this public awareness campaign in Central America to tell people how awful the journey was and how unlikely you were to get through and do all that stuff, right? And there's actually good social science research on that people got the message and they came anyway because the horrors that they face in reality are much worse than any sort of perceived risk there. So instead of telling people not to come, let's ask people why they're coming and try to address it on the back end. And part of why I'm doing this work as an academic is because I do think that that's where we can get the most broad agreement. And that's all, I'll own that, right? I will own that everybody can agree, let's make conditions back home safe so that people don't have to come. But you guys are Christians, right? And so we can have the Christian reality is the flip side, the other side. And so I made this argument with the folks from the UN last week that people have a right not to migrate. They have a right to live in safety and dignity where they are. What the Catholic encyclical tradition especially says on the back end is if that right isn't realized, right? That is, if people can't live in safety and dignity where they are, then they have the right to migrate and to go somewhere where they can, and it's incumbent on Christians to welcome in the stranger. I'm not going to make that argument in the halls of power in Washington, D.C., because I think they'll laugh at me if I tell them, well, Jesus said we have to welcome the stranger and this is what we're going to do. But I do think that's a hard teaching, right? And that is hard. And Lisa mentioned my friend John in San Antonio, who his church does continue to welcome them in. I'll warn you guys, right? This work will change you, right? Mm-hmm. What he says is this kind of work has changed his church. And not only changed his church because now they do everything in English and in Spanish, right? And that's kind of a pain for those of us who are bilingual because you can never remember which language to listen in, right? That's kind of a pain. But it's changed his understanding of the Eucharist. Right? When they take communion and they talk about Christ's broken body in a church full of broken bodies, right? Of a church full of people who've experienced trauma that none of us can understand, man, communion takes on a whole different meaning. He says it changes the way we think about communion. It changes the way we pray. It changes the way we worship. So I would encourage you to get into this work, but do so knowing you're going to be different on the other side. That's a good thing, I think.
Yeah. I have a Bible verse for all of us. And it says, it's in Matthew 25:34, and it says, then the king will say to those on his right, come, you who are blessed by my Father, take your inheritance, the kingdom, prepared for you since the creation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, and you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me in. I needed clothes, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you looked after me. I was in prison, and you came to visit me. Then the righteous will answer him, Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and gave you something to drink? When were you a stranger, and we invited you in, or needed clothes, and clothed you? When did we see you sick or in prison, and went to visit you? The king will reply, truly I tell you, whatever you did for one of the least of these brothers and sisters of mine, you did for me. And so I think that's, the Jewish people wanted the political response for their crisis, right? They were still captives. They were still under the Roman influence. And what they wanted was a political leader. And yet Jesus does not give that answer. He gives something better. Yep. He gives a new kingdom, the kingdom that turns everything upside down. And so Jesus did not come for political reasons. He came for that kingdom. He came to show glory. He came to show that there is a better way. And I think that if we as Christians don't understand that our first allegiance is not to government, but to Christ, and this has been said better by people like Luther, Martin Luther King Jr., then we are missing the point. I think this is, vote however you want. There's pros, there's cons, there's kingdom things, and both sides, that's a whole different thing. But like, make your allegiance to Jesus. Mm-hmm. Be the hand and feet, because that's what we're called to. And if you're not doing that, then consider another religion, because the gospel and gospel work is messy, it's heartbreaking, but it's good. And so, again, like, just read the Bible and pray and like, make sure that you understand what Jesus said.
Well, if you look at the Old Testament, there's so many, there's God's judgment on the people of Israel. So many times it goes to back how they were treating the widow, orphan, and immigrant.
Sorry, there's another question there.
So when the kids come over, and you said like they'll stay 20 days and then they go to LA or New York, who decides that? And then they end up in these impoverished, so do they say, I have an auntie somewhere? Or what if they don't have anybody anywhere? So how does it get decided? And
95% of the children that we've worked with are go with the next of kin, a relative. And so they come with a phone number, they come with a name, or we do the research. So part of what's taking the 19, 20 days is that we're identifying who those individuals are, doing the best we can to make sure that it's a safe place for the child, that they want the child, et cetera. So yeah, 95% of our kids go to those places. And so they happen to live all over the country.
So if they don't go to you, where do they go? I mean, you have when those kids come over and we see those images, if it's not a kind of organizations like you, the kids in the cages, what happens?
So if there's not enough beds, and that's this one thing the government's been wrestling with, is how to have enough beds, and how, you know, so a few months ago they had these huge tents that were warehousing the kids, and it was awful. But where do they go? I can give you a couple of addresses of hotels that I know that have been taken over by the government because they don't have a place for these kids. And it's hard because you're thinking that, okay, we're in the summer, it's gonna be hot, numbers are gonna go down, it didn't go down. And so, then we have things like in Texas, we have a couple of sites, but our residential shelter, the governor of Texas in June, said that he no longer wanted shelters like ours in the state and he wouldn't license us. He wouldn't renew our licenses. Our license happened to be coming up, and it was due to be renewed August 31st.
Why?
He says that is because it affects the foster care system in Texas. I say that's not true, because it doesn't. There's other reasons behind it that you can probably figure out, but yeah. And so, so the federal government proceedings in court, we don't get money from the state to do this. It's a federal government paid program. So the federal government says, we'll license you, keep operating. And so the state they've done some surprise visits, probably trying to figure out where they can close us down, but we've been fine. So we just keep operating.
I just wanna say thank y'all so much for doing the hands and being the hands and feet of Jesus. And I guess my question is, a lot of us, what we know of refugees is from the news, right? And very much depends on what news you watch, what you're mm-hmm. hearing about refugees and migrants. What would you guys say, as people who work directly with the people, what would you say is the biggest misconception that we have about migrants?
Oh, come on. I gotta take a minute to think about that.
I'll give you a minute.
Okay, thanks.
I think that these are folks desperate for a better life. These are folks who don't intend to harm anyone. And they want to contribute. You know, like I said, these teens, we have to say, no, we've got to, you can't go to work right now. You can't do this. And so I think for a country that is, that has grown, our country has grown primarily because of immigrants. For a country where our future, for those of us getting older, our future is dependent on the younger generations working, we need them. We need them. They will do the work. Unfortunately, they'll do the work that no one else will do. We don't want that to be the case. We don't want that to end there. But we need them. And employers need them. A lot of employers, you go to Texas, it's common to find ways to employ them. They've got to figure out how to get around the loops, but yeah.
Yeah. So what Lisa said. But also, I mean, I think these folks are folks just like you and me, right? And for good and bad, right? I mean, I've worked with some of these folks that'll drive you nuts, just like some people I work with in my day job at Baylor drive me nuts too, right? So there's that. But when I say they're just like you and me, I can't imagine sending my child on this journey by themselves. I can't imagine my 14-year-old representing herself in court in another language, because with migration stuff, it's a civil matter, it's not a criminal matter, so the state doesn't provide you a lawyer if you can't afford one, right? You got a 10-year-old defending themselves in court. I can't imagine that. But I also can't imagine not being able to feed my family. I can't imagine the gangs forcibly recruiting my 14-year-old daughter, right? Or a son. I can't imagine that, and I would do anything I possibly could to keep my family safe. Even, even this. One thing that's come up a lot in our conversation just now, and it comes up every time I talk to an immigration lawyer, is they tell me the thing that their clients most need are trauma services, right? I mean, they need legal help navigating the legal system too, but I even had one immigration lawyer tell me, he says, look, all of my clients need a social worker. I'm not a social worker. I run a legal office. I don't know how to supervise a social worker. Maybe I should hire one, but I don't know what they do, but I know that every single person, and again, everyone I talk to, once those folks are here, the trauma and some of the things we were talking about in the earlier session about the long-term effects of trauma and how that works, and the very same skills that kept these kids safe on the journey to the U.S., right? Whether, there's a little boy in this church in San Antonio that he had to be the cutest kid in the room, and he had to hug you and touch you and all that, right? That can be really dangerous in some ways, right? Now, that's what kept him from being abused on the journey. Nobody was going to hurt the cutest kid in the room. So the very same thing that keeps you safe in a trauma situation can actually be harmful later. And so one of the things that we just have to do with this population is help them work through that trauma. So that's a very long way of saying, what do I wish people knew about migrants is that they're just like you and me, with all of our strengths and weaknesses and foibles, and they're just like you and me. They're doing everything they can to help their families and to provide for them. And come to Texas. We'll take you to see some of the folks Lisa works with. I'll take you to San Antonio to meet my buddy with this really goofy, messed up church that does all of this really cool work. We'll show it to you.
I'm going to close us up with three Bible verses because that's what I do. I'm going to tell you, one, remember Genesis 1:27, created in the image of God. Yeah. All of us, legal, illegal, rich, poor, black, white, everybody has been created by God with his image, and therefore inherently important. Mm-hmm. Number two, the Great Commission, right, in Matthew 28, go therefore and make disciples of all nations. It does not matter their legal status. It does not matter their age. It does not matter what you think of them. Like, Christ doesn't care what you think of the Great Commission. This is an order, and he's the king, and we are to obey. And so go therefore and make disciples. That means maybe, like, you're Latino, little cute kid that needs help. And number three, remember where we come from. In Romans 8, it says that we're grafted into a people. Gentiles, and I don't know, I mean, if anybody of you is of Jewish origin, then this probably does not apply to you. But if you are not, you're a Gentile. You're either Jewish or Gentile. And if you are a Gentile, you have been taken from where you were a Gentile into a Jewish, into the chosen people. So remember that that when you encounter a migrant, you were also a migrant. You have also been taken into a kingdom, into a chosen people. And so I think that if we understand those three, we can understand that we are all basically the same, and we all are hopeless until we meet Jesus. So I hope this is just the first thoughts that you can start praying about and taking to God to see how you can get involved, where you can get involved, if you need to get involved. Thank you for your time, and hope it does good.